You're very kind. Thank you very much. And, well, I really appreciate that you've come into this Turkish... Hello, hello. Can you hear me? Is that any better? Yeah, yeah. Shall I hold it? Is that better? Hello. You'll tell me if you can't hear me, won't you? I was going to say thank you very much, especially those of you who are inside here, for coming to the Turkish Baths at Greenbelt this year. And it brings a whole new dimension to sweaty close fellowship. But I really appreciate it. And also the fact that it's just right at the very beginning of the festival, and you know, some of you only just got settled in, and you've bothered to come here to this opening session. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much. And I am talking really from the new book, which has already been mentioned, Black Sheep and Prodigals. I always feel it's quite important, especially I feel with my books anyway, to say the subtitle too. You know, How to Be a Bad Christian and a Better Human Being. That's right. And this is Black Sheep and Prodigals, an antidote to black and white religion. In a way, this book is it's kind of my personal credo, really. It isn't that in a sense of propositions, but rather things that I feel deeply committed to. It's not a definitive statement of my faith, it's work in progress. I've changed quite a lot over the years, as some of you will know, and so it's quite likely I'll carry on doing that, and I hope you do too. But in a way, this is the chapters are all kind of I believes. They're all things that I believe. And in a way, you know, it wouldn't have made as good a title, really. But in a way, you could say that it's a bad Christian systematic theology. Because really, hidden behind my tongue-in-cheek title, chapter titles, are really most of the major themes of the Christian faith, really, most of the major doctrines. I'm trying to give my take on these ideas and so on, especially written, as the last couple of books of mine have been, with people in mind who never come near Greenbelt, who never come near a church. Those people, those hordes of people, and I know there are hordes of people outside of the Christian fold, as it were, who are on their own spiritual journeys and who are open, and God is part of their life and part of their journey, named or unnamed. And it's those people I've written to, but also, of course, to reflect my own particular heretical views. So, you know, it is all each chapter I believe, although the second chapter is I believe beliefs are overrated. They're only words after all. I believe God is just a word. What would happen if we dumped it? I believe in poetry, art, and rock and roll. Did God write any good tunes lately? This obviously is about divine revelation. I believe in evolution and the Big Bang and other creation myths. I believe in original goodness. We enter the world in a state of grace. Also, I believe someone who punishes his son for other people's shortcomings needs counseling. Even if he is God. And so on. And one of the chapters toward the end is called I Believe God is Human. It's the rest of us I'm not sure about. And that's really the sort of chapter which is the main focus of what I want to talk about here today. I think really I've always been something of a black sheep. My dad said it was being pig-headed. And as I pig-headedly said back to him, it takes one to know one. I learned the art of pig-headedness from my dad. I remember him saying, you know, you're pig-headed, son, and you're going to pay a big price for it. Well, he probably was right, you know. That said, I think the price has been well worthwhile. But I think I've always had something of a conformity deficit, really. You know, that when someone says, this is what you've got to believe, or this is the way you've got to behave, somehow the opposite or some alternative tends to come to mind. And that's what I want to explore. So clearly this book is written for people who have a similar conformity deficit, which I sense there's quite a bit of here. Now, I wrote a book a few years back called Reenchanting Christianity. And in that book, I kind of tried to reveal what was my spiritual and theological posture, you know, not so much trying to give a kind of a definitive statement, but what is the broad posture, the direction from which I'm coming from. And I chose to call it progressive orthodoxy, an oxymoron, obviously. But really what I was describing was a faith that is fed and nurtured by a rootedness in Christian tradition, that's the kind of orthodox bit, if you like, but which is also shaped and energized by a dynamic interaction with the world of the present, and hopefully reaching out to the world as it is becoming in the future. In an essay written some years ago, Rowan Williams identified two distinctly different approaches to the term orthodoxy. The first is a closed system. It's pre-packed, predetermined, watertight, a comprehensive ideology. This sort of orthodoxy stifles thought and distorts perception. There's no real conversation in it at all. It's a monologue, really. No critical elements are admitted. And the reason that there's no conversation about this kind of orthodoxy is because actually everything has already been said, and all that's left for us to do is repeat it ad nauseam, again and again and again. So there's nothing new to say, in a way. All we have to do is receive this package called Orthodox Christian faith from those before us and preserve it just as it is. And being faithful to the gospel means handing it just the same on to the next generation. But there's a second approach to orthodoxy, which is basically what I call progressive orthodoxy. Here, orthodoxy is not seen as pre-packed truth handed down from the past, but as a tradition of shared speech, shared symbols, a living community. It's orthodoxy as a community of revelation and dialogue, a tradition that invites a process of constant critical questioning. This approach to orthodoxy doesn't claim to have the truth, to possess the truth, simply to have perspectives on it, or actually to make what a lovely, lovely man who was one of my parishioners until just recently, he passed on at the age of 93, a very famous author called Nicholas Moseley, and he wrote one of his autobiographies from many years back called Efforts at Truth. And I just love that title, and I said to him before he died, I wish I had got that title before you. Because that, in a way, describes my posture spiritually and theologically. It's about efforts at truth rather than having attained truth. And so progressive orthodoxy centers on a dialogue between the traditions of the past and the insights and struggles of the present. It affirms that there are always new things to see and understand, that divine revelation is a constant process rather than a one-off event somewhere in the past. So that's really where I'm coming from in what I'm saying and what I've been writing in books since I wrote about that in Reenchanting Christianity. And based on this approach, Black Sheep is, as I say, my personal credo. A long, long time ago, John Robinson, you remember the former Bishop of Woolwich who wrote Honest to God, he wrote another book after that called But This I Can't Believe. And it was sort of his kind of take on many of the things about Christianity, the Christian faith, as received, that he felt he couldn't believe. And it's a good book. I like it very much. I like a lot of what John Robinson was about. In a way, Black Sheep and Prodigals is me saying, but this I can believe. It's sort of twisting that round, really. And of course, there's a lot in it about what I can't believe, but I'm only saying that in order to say what it is that I do believe, what I do feel really committed to, and what I want to proclaim with every last breath in my body. Black Sheep is an attempt to present a faith that is, on the one hand, consonant with the Christian tradition, which is in continuity. And I think that really Christian faith always needs to be both in continuity and also in discontinuity. And it's the tension between those two things, I think, where we make that our efforts at truth. And so I'm trying to express and present a faith that is consonant with the Christian tradition, but which is also both credible in a scientific age and also humane in today's world, in its sensibilities, in the way it looks upon the world, upon people, upon creation, and so on. So, for instance, I believe that we need a faith that acknowledges wholeheartedly the 13 billion year history of cosmic evolution and our own evolution here as human beings, as earthlings, as part of the community of Earth. And we need a theology that integrates the consequences of cosmic evolution with our Christian tradition. It's not just a case of saying, oh, yeah, well, I believe that, you know, this is, it began with a big bang and so on and so forth. But what does that mean for our faith? How does that impact our faith in all the sort of many different details of it? Evolution isn't just, you know, a sort of theory or an idea about the origins of humanity and of the Earth in general. But it's also a way of thinking about the way we are as human beings and therefore the way faith will operate. And so it needs to, I think, shape our understanding, for instance, of the human condition, away from a literal interpretation of the creation myths and the myth of the story of the Garden of Eden in the Bible, which I happen to think is an utterly splendid story, an amazing, a truthful story. It's an effort at truth. But it never was designed to be a literal explanation of how the world came into being or how, you know, the human condition became flawed in the way that we know and understand that it is. And therefore, you know, the idea of original sin based on, as Augustine did, the story of Adam and Eve in the garden and so on, to me makes no sense whatsoever in the 21st century. And in fact, it makes no sense to me in observation anyway. I just cannot believe that those little babies that people so proudly hand me by the font in my church and I hold and cradle in my arms are born in sin. I don't believe that. Do I believe that their lives will be flawed and fraught as every human being's is? Yes, of course I do, but that's saying something quite different and is coming from a different direction. So, you know, I think that actually what's named as sin, which I think is actually a particularly unhelpful word actually now in today's world, it's so laden with a history. But I think what we attempt to talk about in the word sin, I think is much more explicable as part of our evolution as human beings, as we sort of are constantly making choices and wrestling with the more primitive parts of our evolutionary humanity and the higher parts of our humanity, which are part of what has been revealed in the process of evolution. I'm not going to talk about that right now, but it gives you a sort of hint of what I'm talking about. But I also want a theology, as well as being something that's meant to be understandable, capable of being followed and credible in a way that non-believers are led to, the only great and real mystery that we designate by the name God. It's my passion to speak not just to the sort of so-called converted, but to people who, as I say, in their own way, are looking for some way of grappling with the great mystery behind the universe that we call God. But sometimes, for many of them, the word God is an unhelpful word. You know, there have been, but Paul Tillich, back in the mid-20th century, advocated a 100-year neglect of the word God, you know, that we should have a moratorium for at least a century on the word God. Well, that's not going to happen, obviously, but I think it was a great idea, and I understand where he was coming from in doing that. I was recently invited to give a talk at the Philosophy Society in a London university college, and my brief was to talk about religion and homosexuality, but with a philosophical twist. And I was told that the Philosophical Society were a company of people who would all be relatively friendly atheists. So I took this brief on wholeheartedly, and I announced my topic as, "I met God, she's a lesbian." Ontology, wait for the subtitle, Ontology for a Bad Christian. Among other things, the talk focused on the many unexpected and perhaps shocking ways and forms in which God shows up in our world. The following day, I received several emails of appreciation. One that particularly interested me read, "I've always thought of myself as an atheist. I don't like religion. And to be honest, I was shocked and not well pleased when I discovered a priest was talking to us. in our philosophy society. I thought we would get a sermon and you'd try to make us join the church or something, but you shook me to the roots. I found myself agreeing with everything you said. If what you described really is God, then I don't think I can call myself an atheist anymore. I think that you know, there are so many people who are just like that, I think. And therefore, I can well cope with being shot down a few times by people who think that I've missed my way and I'm going to hell and all the rest of it, if I can manage to make some sense to people like that young woman there. And she's far from alone, as I say. Hordes of people abandon the idea of religion because the kind of faith, the kind of God that they think is on offer appears implausible, or worse still, repellent, or utterly toxic in a world where violence and terror are executed in God's name. Indeed, for many people, atheism actually is an ethical stance. Atheism is an ethical stance of protest against the things done and propounded in God's name. In the mid-20th century, recognizing the erosion of credibility in the name God, as I say, the theologian Paul Tillich proposed a moratorium on its use. And I think his point is well made. God, in quotes, is probably the most used and abused word in history. Even as long ago as the 13th century, the Christian mystic Meister Eckhart exclaimed, "I pray God to rid me of God." And I pray God for a drink of water. I want a faith that takes rationality and scientific insight seriously, but also which is deeply and profoundly humane in its nature. So, for example, I can't possibly accept an approach to faith that essentially excludes people with LGBT instincts, or which denies same-sex couples an equal opportunity for marriage if that's what they choose, or treats transgender people as outsiders to some arbitrary notion of normality. These attitudes and policies, I believe, are profoundly wrong. Indeed. They are deeply mistaken and also inhumane. And I know that because I deal with people on the receiving end of this sort of theology and idea all the time. And I know the inhumanity of it. I know that there are people who have said to me, as one particular woman did, you know, "I love you, Dave. I love your church. I love what you're about. But how can I be part of an institution that essentially hates me, that excludes me?" And I understand this. I mean, it doesn't just stop at that sort of thing. The inhumanity is expressed in things like the idea of eternal torment. Thank goodness it's beginning to wane a bit, this eternal torment. It's not quite eternal anymore, but, you know, I think it must be the ultimate in inhumanity as an idea. What sort of God would be behind such a thing? And then there's, you know, this problem of heaven. I mean, I long ago gave up belief in anything resembling the notion of hell that I grew up with, and which I have to tell you kept me awake at night as a young boy. It frightened me to death. It frightened me that people that I knew and liked, my friends and so on, who didn't believe in Jesus, were going to be suffering in hell for eternity. I mean, the concept of people suffering for eternity because they didn't believe in Jesus, or actually even if they committed horrendous crimes against humanity, has to be one of the most brutally psychotic ideas ever imagined, and certainly unworthy of any faith claiming to worship and center on a God of love. Apart from anything else, how could eternal torment and eternal bliss coexist? How could they coexist? Surely the one obliterates the other. What sort of people would party forever while others suffered interminable misery, however bad we might reckon that they had been? What sort of God would preside over such a state of affairs? The God of Jesus Christ, according to what I see in him and what he taught, would surely rescue the tormented, even if it took all eternity to do so. The popular notion of hell is, in my view, an affront to spiritual intelligence. Even if eternal torment were plainly in the Bible, I would oppose it in the name of God. but it isn't in the Bible, actually. As John Sweeney has persuasively argued in a book called Inventing Hell, Dante, the Bible and Eternal Torment, good read, he's persuasively argued that the popular notion of hell is really the product of the medieval imagination, spectacularly articulated in Dante's Inferno, but now so embedded in Christian myth and consciousness that it's routinely read back into biblical text, even though closer examination reveals that it isn't actually there. So the question that people often ask me when I talk like this is, but aren't you just inventing God in your own image? You know, you're just sort of reinventing a God that suits you, that fits with your sensibilities and so on and so forth. But the question I have to ask you is, what objective means do we have of picturing or understanding God? God, whatever we mean by that word, is the greatest and uttermost mystery of the universe that cannot possibly be reduced to human categories and words. And therefore, all that we have are analogies, all we have are metaphors to try to understand what this is. Jesus, certainly for me as a Christian, is probably my ultimate lens for understanding what I mean by the word God. But actually, I think that we also look for God and find God by looking into the depths of our own being too. That we, as creatures made in God's image, and indeed in creation as a whole, I look to find what I mean by God. Do I think that God is personal? God is a sort of personal being, our Father, and so on and so forth. Well, I think that's an impossible question ultimately to answer, really. I don't know whether the mystery behind the universe can actually be understood in human personal terms is a good argument to have, really. What I do believe is that whilst I don't think God is personal in that human sense, I think that God is more than personal, that everything we mean by personal is embodied in God, and more, that God is therefore transpersonal or super personal, if you like. And certainly what I can say is the way that I know and understand and connect with God is personally. But that doesn't necessarily in itself determine what I mean by God, but I think that, or what God is, but I think that I certainly expect that a God that I can show allegiance to and worship and adore and love and be passionate about has to be the expression of everything that human beings are at their very, very best and a lot more. Okay, let me just tell you a story which is in the book. It's a story about a man called Hans Küng. Do you know Hans Küng? Hans Küng is one of the greatest Christian thinkers of our time, and an architect of the Second Vatican Council, which modernized to some large extent the Catholic Church in the early 1960s, though he was later censured by the Vatican for being too liberal. For such a giant, and I have got at least two shelves full of his books, you know, for such a giant to be offered as a dinner guest at our house was a little bit scary. But this is what happened some years ago. Küng, who was born in Switzerland in 1928, in his mid-20s he was ordained as a priest in the Catholic Church, and at the amazingly young age of 31 became a professor of theology at Tübingen. He has written, I think, 70 or more books. I think he's outrageously readable for a theological academic. He has addressed the UN General Assembly shortly after 9/11 on the future of international politics, served on a 20-person group of eminent persons set up by Kofi Annan. He's a friend to many heads of government and leaders of the world religions, and has basically got more academic and humanitarian awards than you can shake a stick at. He's a rock star, really. You know, he's a rock star of global theology. And yet, in the eyes of the conservative Catholic establishment, he's a black sheep. a subversive rebel, a free thinker who had to be silenced. Over the decades, he challenged the authority of the Pope. He argued in favor of gay relationships. He has canvassed for women priests, stated that if Jesus of Nazareth returned, he would welcome divorcees into the church, described the Vatican's prohibition on birth control as pernicious, and encouraged Catholic parishes to keep their priests after they marry, even if church law declares that they're no longer priests. So a thoroughly Orthodox Catholic, really. He's one of my heroes, I have to say that. So the prospect of entertaining him in our home for dinner was just a little bit delightful and terrifying. My wife, Pat, who's sitting over in the corner here, she shared my excitement, but was, you know, characteristically a little less starstruck than me. I remember when I showed her a copy of one of Kung's books on my shelf, which is called Does God Exist? It's about 950 pages, about this thick, you know. She sort of flicked through the pages and sort of said, is that a yes then? But she loves a good story, and Hans had plenty of them to tell. I'm not sure how accustomed the Herr Professor was to sitting at a family table, but after an extra helping of Pat's roast, he relaxed and began to talk, probably much too freely, about his fascinating life and his relationship with Pope John the 23rd, a magnificent human being who initiated Vatican II but sadly died before it was completed. He told us about Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, later Pope Benedict, of course, played a significant part in banning Kung's teaching from the church in 1979. And we had fun quizzing him about what would be the first thing that he would change if he was Pope. It's interesting that he said the first thing he would do would be to dump enforced celibacy for priests, which was an interesting one. You know, and he said, you may think I would say marry, embrace homosexuals or marry or ordain women. But he said, actually, this is the stone at the bottom of the whole wall, because it's a view of humanity. It's a view of sexuality and who we are as people. So anyway, after dinner, I jumped at his offer to sign my copies of his books. And when Pat handed him Does God Exist, pointing to the title, well, I knew exactly what was coming next. Is that a yes then, Hans? I held my breath, quite sure that no one had ever put the question to him in quite that way before. And a broad grin went across his wrinkled face, and he wrote in the front of the book, yes, read it. To which my wife, who has always been good at having the last word, said, well, I don't really need to now, you've told me the answer. One of the topics that I was so eager to discuss with Hans Kung was his work on what he calls the global ethic, the creation of a consensus among the world's religions on a set of shared ethics and standards and attitudes. The world, he told me, is torn apart by politics and religion. We must learn to live together peacefully and share responsibly in caring for the earth and for each other. We need a basic moral code, a global ethic. Now, while he never saw the global ethic as an exclusively religious thing, he always wanted an alliance of believers and non-believers, if you like. Kung was convinced that religion has to lead the way, not least because religion is implicit in most of the world's major problems. And so he wrote in the front of one of my books, which is called Yes to the Global Ethic, no peace among the nations without peace among the religions. No peace among the religions without dialogue between the religions. The central plank of the global ethic, a deeply humane policy that Hans Kung has brought before us, is the so-called golden rule, some version of which exists in every single religious tradition. But actually, it's just what we know as human beings is right to do to others as you would have them do to you. At the 1993 Parliament of the World's Religions, I bet you didn't even know there was one, did you? The Parliament of World's Religions in Chicago, more than 200 leaders from over 40 different faith traditions signed a declaration toward a global ethic, which was drafted by Hans Kung. And it was based on the assumption that every person, without distinction of age, sex, sexuality, gender, race, skin color, physical or mental ability, language, religion, political view, or national or social origin possesses an inalienable and untouchable dignity, and everyone, the individual as well as the state, is therefore obliged to honor this dignity and protect it. Now, that is what I believe is a humane approach to faith. Now, despite being signed back in 1993, far from losing its relevance, of course, the global ethic is more relevant today than it ever has been. And I fear that Hans Kung, who's now an old man and not in the best of health, is probably going to pass off this mortal coil before he sees an awful lot of fulfillment of his global ethic. But I think it's for all of us in our own ways, both at sort of global levels and at our own little mini level in our own neighborhoods. It's up to us to take up and further the idea of a global ethic, to find a way of working with people of good faith to ensure that these principles are answered and fulfilled. Kung was awarded the Otto Hahn Peace Medal in Berlin for exemplary commitment to humanity, tolerance, and dialogue between the great world religions for his work on the global ethic. And in his ceremonial speech, Kung took the opportunity to stress to a very predominantly secular audience that this wasn't about religion, that you didn't have to be religious to subscribe to what he was talking about. And so he sketched out a philosophical basis for a global ethic, which had no necessary reliance on religious beliefs. You see, the real distinction highlighted by Kung's global ethic is that the real distinction in the world is not between people who are religious and people who are not religious, people who are Christians and non-Christians, saved, not saved, all of those other categories that we can sort of churn out. That's not the thing. But between those who adhere to a practice of compassion and empathy, and who recognize that a culture of greed, selfishness, and inhumanity is something that we must all evolve out of. We must move beyond. There are people in all religions and none who pursue both of these pathways, both the pathway of empathy and compassion and justice, and people who pursue the pathway of inhumanity, of greed, of ultimately insanity. And we see this very clearly. I mean, you know, I don't mean to be political here, but why not? You know, I mean, to look at what's happening in the United States, you know, a country that I have a great love for, and I have so many friends in the United States. But to see what is, you know, what is going on there, not so much in the sort of horrors of what Donald Trump is about and what he represents, but in the support he is getting from, you know, predominantly white Christian audience is just unbelievable. And, you know, I think that it behoves everyone. I mean, and the truth is, you know, when I listen to some of those people talking and read some of the things about, I just think, you know, this is a different religion altogether to the one that I know about. It's very different to the faith that I think is centered on the person of Jesus Christ. But what's for sure is that no individual or group, religious or not religious, has got a corner on either goodness or stupidity. It's very clear to me that Confucius, the Buddha, Jesus of Nazareth, the Prophet Muhammad were all strong advocates of humanity and a more humane world. Also that despite massive differences, humanist ethics and the ethics of the world religions converge significantly on a basic understanding of what it means to be truly human. So like Hans Kung, I happily describe myself as both a Christian and a humanist. Now, I grew up in a sort of form of Christianity that saw humanists as being like, you know, horns on their heads, you know, forked tails and all the rest of it, you know, that humanism was assumed to be the enemy of Christian faith. I don't believe that at all, and actually some of my best friends are humanists of a non-religious sort. But actually, I don't think there is any conflict between the two at all. Indeed, I'm convinced that Christianity is intrinsically humanistic, especially when viewed through the lens of Jesus of Nazareth and the Golden Rule. So let me just give you these, you know, 6 or 7 points that I want to just quickly flash up for you. As a Christian and a humanist, this is kind of my manifesto, if you like. One, I believe that our most basic reality is that we are earthlings. We share in the 4.6 billion year sacred story of planetary evolution. We're intricately interconnected with the whole biosphere and its creatures. And in an age of ecological crisis, we must establish sustainable environmental policies and practices for the good of the whole planet. That's my first one. The second one is, I believe that regardless of differences of religion, gender, ethnicity, skin color, sexual orientation, social status, and all that sort of stuff, what unites us most fundamentally is a common humanity. That's the most basic thing that unites us. First and foremost, fundamentally, I am a human being, and then a Christian, and that by choice. But what I have no choice about is that I'm a human being, and I share a common humanity with everybody else. The greatest threat to the world lies in the refusal of many to honor this essential fact and therefore to respect difference. Thirdly, I believe in the value and dignity of each person, that there is that of God in everyone, as the Quakers like to say. And therefore, every human being deserves to be valued and accorded the greatest possible freedom that's compatible with the rights of other people. Fourthly, or whatever that is, I believe that morality is an intrinsic part of human nature, that a person doesn't need to be religious in order to have morals and ethics. You don't need God to be good, as atheists quite often tell us. Then I believe in the absolute freedom of rational inquiry, that no belief, creed, or conviction should be beyond question. And indeed, I think quite the reverse, that being faithful to our faith means nurturing and encouraging critical reaction. So therefore, I encourage you to disagree with me. I don't ask you to come here today and believe everything that I'm saying. I'm not sure I do myself. But, I think that churches really need to be laboratories of spiritual intelligence. You know, places where we nurture spiritual intelligence, not where we sort of churn out conformist sets of beliefs and ideas that everyone is supposed to agree with and sign up to in order to be part of this club. I encourage people to disagree with me in my sermons or whatever. That is not really the issue. In fact, I'm a bit disappointed if all the people do is just agree with everything that I say. I've obviously failed in the task I'm trying to go about. There is no necessary conflict between science and religion, between reason and faith. God and evolution gave us the capacity jointly, if you like, to observe and reflect, to doubt and question, to listen and discuss, and then to decide, and then to decide again. And I think it would be rude and, in fact, stupid not to use that capacity to the full extent that we possibly can. I also believe in democracy, human rights, and the maximum possible conditions for human flourishing. And consequently, that it's our responsibility to seek justice and equality for every person, including those people who totally and utterly disagree with what I'm saying here today. I will fight for their right to disagree with me, to hold a different opinion. There's more to be said about that, but I'll leave it there. I believe that personal liberty must be combined with social responsibility, that we may vigorously disagree with others, but never bully or attempt to coerce them into agreement. I believe in a society where vastly different creeds and worldviews can coexist peacefully in mutual respect. I, for one, do not want to convert all the Muslims and Buddhists and Hindus to become Christians. I don't want to do that personally. I think that the world is benefited by the diversity of approaches and insights to God and faith that we have in the world today. I will argue passionately until the cows come home and they've gone away again and come back for dinner. I will argue with people who have different views to me. But I'm not out to just simply try to convert them to join my club. Or let them convert me to theirs. Finally, I believe that these beliefs, that all beliefs are actually worthless unless they support and lead us into the practice of treating others as we ourselves wish to be treated. This is not only at the heart of all religion, but it's at the core of what it means to be human. Now, these kind of principled ideas that I've just expounded, whilst Jesus never explicitly voiced these proposals, as you might have noticed, I'm convinced that they represent in modern form and idiom the sort of values and priorities that he embodied and that he proclaimed in the Gospels and especially in the Sermon on the Mount. He constantly affirmed the dignity and value of people who were marginalized and stigmatized in his society, women, children, immigrants, so-called sinners, and the ritually unclean. He boiled the 613 laws from the Hebrew Bible down to just two basic essentials. Love God with all that you are and love your neighbor as yourself. He taught people to critically evaluate the religious dogmas of the day and to look at the heart of their religion instead of worrying about the rules and the conventions. That's why he was considered a heretic by those around him in his time. At the same time as being kind and generous toward the poor, the excluded, and the defamed, Jesus relentlessly criticized the wealthy and the powerful, and especially the self-serving religious establishment. He denounced nationalism and tribalism, often making foreigners and social misfits the heroes of his stories. He commended reaching out to strangers and taught us to love our enemies. He condemned social injustice and greed and called on the wealthy and influential to use their privilege to benefit others. He gave a voice to the voiceless and stood up for the rights of those who had no rights. He said that the way we treat other people directly reflects the actual nature of our religion. Now, I could give you a chapter and verse if you want for these things, but I think you know it's true. This is who Jesus is. This is what he taught. And these kind of things make me a follower of Jesus, keep me on the Christian path when I am profoundly tempted at times to walk away from it and find something. I have no difficulty with Jesus as the decisive revelation of God in human form, but frankly, I get bored with 4th century convoluted arguments about the deity of Christ. What I and others want is to push the world in a more humane direction. For that task, we seek a Jesus who is not an omnipotent God in a man suit, but someone like us, who looked for God at the center of his life and called the world to join him, who is the model of what it is to be human and showed us the humanity of God. So these are things that I see as being forming the foundation of what I believe is a Christian embracing of humanism. Back in 2012, in the beer tent, the Jesus Arms, on this, well, not this site, actually, but in Cheltenham. It was, wasn't it? Yes, 2012, yes. I launched a book in a very, very muddy night and a muddy site called How to Be a Bad Christian and a Better Human Being. And the weather was foul, perfect festival conditions. And I was quite excited about that book. I was quite excited about what it represented. And somebody said to me at the end of the evening, "You were on fire tonight, Dave. You were like a liberal evangelist." So I went to bed pondering this oxymoron. And somewhere in the wee hours of the night, I decided that I could embrace this, that I think I will own the tag liberal evangelist. The liberal and evangelical approaches to faith often represent different ends of the spectrum, of course. But suddenly, the combination seemed to appeal to me. I'm fed up, really, of a liberal, progressive approach to Christian faith that is just so cerebral and so disconnected from a personal spirituality. I find it intellectually often very satisfying, but it's not going to fire people to go out and change the world. At the same time, I'm really fed up of all the sort of tub-thumping, go-get-people-for-Jesus sort of stuff that I think is just a little party amongst a circle of people whilst the world outside is languishing. I believe the world, our world, needs a generous-spirited, progressively-minded faith proclaimed with all the zeal and passion of an evangelist. Black and white religion, like black and white thinking in general, is a large part of the problem in our world and has got nothing to do with the way forward. It creates an us and them mentality. It interprets sacred texts and traditions in a way that locks us into the past instead of thrusting us forward into the future with imagination and hope. It feeds our fear of difference instead of helping us to see beyond those differences, and so on and so forth. I remember seeing a cartoon some years ago that had a little sort of character going along holding a sign that said, "Christ is the answer." And behind was another person with a sign saying, "What was the question?" I don't believe that the sectarian black and white Christ of black and white Christianity that I have grown up on is the answer to very much at all. But the Jesus I find in the Gospels helps me to answer a lot of things. The Jesus who championed the poor and the marginalized, who treated women as real people at a time when they were the chattels of a patriarchal society. The Jesus who forgave his killers and invited a dying thief to join him in paradise. I think if this Jesus were here today, folks, I believe he would lead his disciples on a pride march. He would be in refugee camps, helping people to find a life apart from guns and bombs. He would support the sexually abused and also liberate the offenders from the self-hatred that drives them to harm other people. I believe the Jesus of the Gospels would still be weeping over Jerusalem and supporting those who strive for justice and reconciliation in the Middle East. I believe he would vigorously be pulling down all walls, including those between America and Mexico, should they ever exist. Literal and metaphorical. I'm a Christian. Let me make no sort of mistake about that. I'm a Christian, but I've little interest in spreading Christianity. I'm far more interested in fueling what I would see as a new Jesus movement. As Karen Armstrong writes, Jesus did not spend a great deal of time discoursing about the Trinity or original sin or the incarnation, which have preoccupied later Christians. He went about doing good and being compassionate. But in the end, there's not much good in just thinking about what Jesus might do if he were here today. What is vitally important, is for us to discover the Spirit of Jesus in our hearts and in our communities, and to get out there and let that shine through in every corner of our world. And so my little sort of slogan that I've finished the Black Sheep with is what I leave you with today, which is, friends, live passionately, believe skeptically, love extravagantly. Amen.
Well, what a fantastic start to our programme. Dave's generously agreed to answer questions. It is going to be tricky, I think, to pass the microphone around the room in all sorts of ways. So if you have a question, speak loudly. Yeah, shout. There's a question right here.
So the question, for those who can't hear it, is how I managed to get along with an institution that is requiring me to conform to certain... Yes, I call myself a... Yeah, you know, the interesting thing is, I've talked about this in the book, you know, that the word heretic has come to have a very specific meaning, disagreeing with the institutional kind of status quo of beliefs and so on and so forth. But of course, the word heretic simply means someone with an opinion, really. That's, you know, if you go back to the original word, it's an opinion, someone with an opinion. Well, I think we should all be heretics then. We should all have an opinion. I went to speak at a school in Essex last year, and the head of RE invited me to come and talk to all the sort of different year groups in the school, in the library. I had a fantastic time. I went there scared stupid, to be honest. I mean, kids frighten me because, you know, they'll ask you anything or just not listen and fall asleep. And I had a great day, and I was so impressed with this lovely man who was the head of RE, and he said to me, he said, "Dave, the tension in my job is that on the one hand, I have to get these students through an exam, you know, so I have to get them to sort of know certain, you know, remember certain sort of information, so on and so forth." He said, "That's not what I'm really doing. That's not why I'm a teacher." He said, "I'm a teacher because I want them to find an opinion." And I thought, how fantastic that is. And it gave me hope for the future, really, that someone is wanting to get our young people to find an opinion, you know. And it may be an opinion, it will be an opinion, hopefully, that will change as time's gone and so on. So I think that, you know, part of my brief as I see it anyway, I haven't actually consulted the bishop about it, but I think part of my brief as a parish priest is to create heretics in this sense, you know, to encourage people to have opinions which may be very different to mine. I think I've been very lucky in the support that I've enjoyed from people. I haven't got a long history in the Church of England, as many of you know. I was ordained in 1997. I never thought I would be a parish priest. I thought I'd be a sort of wandering freelancer. And when the bishop said to me that it was very obvious that I should be the vicar of St. Luke's in Holloway, I wasn't at all sure he was right. I happen now to look back on it and think it's probably the best decision, apart from asking Pat to marry me, probably the best decision I've ever made in my life. And I have enjoyed great support from the institution, though there are many within it, of course, who think that I'm sadly, you know, misguided and mistaken and all the rest of it. But, you know, listen, the world is in much too dire a strait for us to worry about what the consequences are of nailing our colours to the mast on a few things. I don't always know what the consequences are of what I'm saying and doing. But I think that, you know, the church, if you care at all about it, and it's a good argument as to whether you think we should care about the church, I do actually, but I think that if you care about the church, then you have to look at a church which is in massive decline. You know, of course there are, you know, a few exceptions where, you know, it's doing better, but overall, and there are people, I think, I meet them all the time, who think that somehow it's all going to sort of change one day, you know, and suddenly people are going to pour through our doors and all the rest of it. I can't see it. But I think that we drastically need, I don't really, on one level, care whether the church finally sort of survives or not, because I don't think that's the issue. I don't think Jesus came to start a church. I think he came to bring his message of the kingdom of God to the world. And I don't think that's going to fade away, but it may be that it's being practiced more effectively in places other than amongst churches and religious communities. And if that's the case, then so be it. But I do actually care enough about the church. I've got a very big foot in that camp that I want to do everything I can to give it the best that I can possibly give it in thrusting it forward in the future effectively. And I think if that's the case, then we've got to stop pussyfooting around and worrying all the time about what the kind of arch conservatives are going to say and how they're going to react and whether they're going to take their bat and ball away. I think that game is one that, you know, is just futile for the future of the Christian faith in our country and in our world.
We have a question right here.
The question is about liturgies and whether you know, what we do about meaningful liturgies. And, you know, for 10 years, I kind of stepped out of mainstream church life to found and run a thing called Holy Joe's, which was a sort of group in a pub, and it was fantastic because I think it actually preserved the faith of a lot of people as well as giving a faith to some. But it was all about creating a context for meaningful discussion and conversation and so on. And I think we really drastically need that, place spaces for honest, meaningful, deep conversations. But I think we need more than that. And that's why I was happy to find myself in the Church of England doing what I'm doing today, because I think that people need rituals and liturgies which can help them to navigate the hazards and the pleasures of life and all the different things that are there. So I do think that we have to find ways to make liturgy and sacraments and prayer and all these things powerful and relevant to the spiritual life of people. A man I admire a great deal in his writings in Australia, who's called David Tacey, thank you, David Tacey. In a lovely book he wrote about contemporary spiritualities, he said that if the church is going to survive and thrive in the 21st century, it needs to shift from what he called devotional worship to become centers of existential spirituality. Now, that's quite a mouthful, but I think what he was meaning was that an awful lot of what goes on in our liturgy and ritual in church is really more kind of ceremonial in a way, or else it's a kind of getting very happy, clappy, and excited within our own little kind of circle. But the point is, meanwhile, people out there are looking for sources of spiritual enrichment and direction in their lives. And I think what he was saying is that people need to be able to come to church in whatever form that is, and find something that nurtures and develops their own kind of spiritual intelligence. And that's a very, you know, if you've read my recent writing, you know, I'm very interested in the idea of spiritual intelligence. And I think there are many people who are outside of the fold of religion who are hugely spiritual intelligent. And there are many people in churches who I think churches often stunt spiritual intelligence by actually, you know, keeping us on this kind of roundabout of conformity and ceremonial and repetition and so on and so forth. So I think, yes, I don't think it has to be sort of throw all this away and reinvent something else. I think it's about finding ways to convert liturgies and sacraments and so on to become real living vehicles for the Spirit of God that will renew and replenish the lives of postmodern travellers in the 21st century.
We have time, I think, for one more question. Thank you.
David, you just talked about spiritual intelligence. I noticed while you were talking about rationality, you also said mystery quite a lot.
Yes.
I quoted Meister Eckhart.
Absolutely.
Do you think that rediscovering what the mystic said is something that we should be doing to resources?
Yes, I do. I advocate both of these things. I think that life, as we know it on this planet, demands and requires great, deep rationality, that we need to think critically and openly and creatively about our life here on planet Earth. But I think that also, as soon as you engage with the world, whether it's with human beings or with the wild places of our world or whatever, you just gaze into the sky, you know there is a mystery that can never be fully named behind and within all of this. And I think that is part of what, you know, I think that developing spiritual intelligence involves the bringing together of those two things. That it's not just about rational intelligence, that's very important, but I think it's also about being able to engage with mystery. And that's a good question, you know, how much do our churches enable people and empower people to engage with mystery in their lives and in the universe? So yes, I think the mystics have got an enormous amount to offer to us. In a way, I'm not in favor of irrationality. I remember once toward the end of my life as a charismatic preacher, going to a church, I think it was probably one of the very last that I went to preach at, actually, where I was clearly about as big a misfit, you know, as, and this person came to me after and said, I've got a prophecy for you, you know. So I said, oh, have you? So he said, yes, the word of God to you is that you're in the mind. So I said, right, so God wants me to be out of my mind. You know, now that sort of irrationality and sometimes under the guise of mystery, oh, it's a mystery, you know, which is a sort of way of slapping you and saying, stop being rational, stop thinking about it, and just sort of, you know, basically conform to what we're, you know, that is the opposite of what, it's a travesty of what mystery is really about. I'm not for irrationality, but I am for non-rationality. So I think that, you know, it's interesting when Paul talks in Corinthians. I did a talk here a few years ago, which some people didn't like, which was called "Is Speaking in Tongues a Right Brain Experience?" And I said in that I thought that speaking in tongues was basically gobbledygook, but none the worse for it. Now, actually, I was giving a defense of speaking in tongues, because what I was saying is that when Paul says, I will speak with the spirit and I will speak with the understanding, I think that was kind of his ancient way of sort of saying that we need both sort of sides of the brain, as we tend to talk about it, left and right, that we need the rational and we need the non-rational. But once you separate these two things apart, I think on the one end you end up with, and I think he's a much maligned man, Richard Dawkins, I do really, but I think that you end up with the sort of thing that he's come to represent, which is this rationality denuded of spirit and mystery. And if you throw away the kind of rationality, then you end up with a kind of irrational mysticism that really has nothing to offer to humanity or the development of the human spirit. So we need these two things to be together. And that, I think, is what spiritual intelligence is about. We need church communities that are, you know, nurturing people, that become universities of spiritual intelligence, you know, where people really grow and evolve, rather than people feeling that they've been sent back to the nursery when they go to church, you know, where they just have to sort of sit there and sing silly choruses, as it were, and recite stupid things, you know. I think that, you know, mystery and rationality are two absolutely crucial twins that have to go together. I wish I had more time, but I think the time is up, and I just thank you for sitting here through this sweaty hour or so. I'm signing books at 7 o'clock over there, and you know, I'm on Facebook and all these sort of things, and I'm always happy and open to engage with people. But really, you know, what I'm here to do most of all is to try to stir up a passion for a new movement in our world, which I think is, for me as a Christian, a Jesus movement, that is about refueling a movement of spiritual intelligence in our world. Our world desperately needs it. You know, I mean, when you look at stuff coming out of Trump Town at the moment, but it's not just there, it's all over the place. You just despair for the future of our world. And, you know, we've got to, you know, get off our backsides, as you will in a moment, and engage with this world positive, creatively, and in a Christ spirit. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.